Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on this Monday edition, another terror attack in the UK. We have latest details about that. Also, divided America. That's something that's been in the news. Well, it's highlighted in big cities against rural communities. Interesting feature piece there. And also, can a person die of a broken heart? A new study shows that it can actually happen. They have the scientific proof to back that up. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Send out some tweets about programming from time to time. And also, if you'd like to send in an email, you can do that to comments at kpcg.fm. Happy to take a look at those for you. Dwight Falk with you here today on this Monday morning. Hopefully everyone had a great weekend and a good Father's Day. If you had some plans, hopefully those worked out. A couple of headlines to start today. The big headline, I think, over the last few days has been this UK terror attack. And this is what the Associated Press says. London's police commander said on Monday that the van attack near Finsbury Park Mosque was, quote, clearly an attack on Muslims. Commander Cressida Dick, speaking Monday in the London neighborhood of Finsbury Park, said people in Muslim communities will see more of their police protecting them in the coming days, so they're going to try to bolster the police force. And London Mayor Sadiq Khan also said, he paid tribute to the local community who apprehended the attacker near the mosque, especially the religious leader who kept him safe from mob violence. Here are some sound bites from those two, the police commander and the mayor of London, regarding the attacks that happened on Sunday. And this is from the Associated Press.
So we are here, as you are well aware, because of the terrible, terrible attack that took place last night. We have a number of people in hospital whose lives are turned upside down. We have one person who has died. And as you are aware, a man has been arrested. This was quite clearly an attack on Muslims who looked like they were probably Muslims and they were coming from a prayer meeting. We treat this as a terrorist attack. We in the Met are as shocked as anybody in this local community or across the country at what has happened. We take all forms of hate crime and violent extremism incredibly seriously. My police officers responded last night within a minute. We had a large presence here within 10 minutes. You'll be aware that we have also responded to other attacks over the last few weeks. And we are also, of course, still all of us, working very hard in relation to the recovery from the horrible events at Grenfell Tower and the investigations that flow from that. This is, as Her Majesty said, a somber time, and last night has added to that somberness.
I've been in close contact with the Commissioner since the attack last night and with senior officers. I attended the Cobra meeting this morning. I want to pay tribute to the fantastic response from the police and emergency services, but also from the local community. The local worshippers apprehended the man in the van who mowed down the pedestrians. I've heard stories from the imam who stopped local residents from understandably taking out their anger on this terrorist. And I pay tribute to Muslim Welfare House, the local council, Jeremy Corbyn and Emily Thorbury for the good work they do as a community hub for the entire community. This attack behind me on Seven Sisters, the attack in Manchester, the attack on London Bridge, the attack on Westminster Bridge, are all an attack on our shared values. Our shared values of tolerance and freedom and respect. And we will not allow these terrorists to succeed. And I want to thank the Commissioner for ensuring that during the course of today and the next few days, Londoners will see an increased number of visible police officers, particularly at and around mosques and places of worship as we approach the holy day of Eid and the last few days of Ramadan. And as the Commissioner said, there will be a zero tolerance towards hate crime. And my message to anyone who's the victim of hate crime is please report it to the police. Don't think it's too trivial. Don't think the police will take action. They will.
So that's some audio there from the Associated Press, and that came from the police commander over there in London, Cressida Dick, and also the mayor over there as well, and Mr. Khan, Sadiq Khan. And so that's some of the comments about that attack yesterday. I guess a little bit of a different situation, potentially, although details are still coming out. It appears that Muslims were targeted in this case. So it's interesting. There'll be more details about that. Definitely a dangerous place. Some of the comments that I read yesterday when looking at that news story were interesting because eyewitnesses were just talking about how afraid they are to be on the streets of London. They're afraid of violence. I mean, these were car attacks in a lot of cases, this one, and then the other one, I guess, van attacks. People are afraid of being targeted on the street just randomly. And so the people were just saying, residents over there that live in London, that they are afraid to go out. And so I'm sure that's not everybody, but some people certainly are. So that's another terror attack that occurred there. Because of these terror attacks, some of these online companies are starting to change some policies or think about changing policies. This comes from Bloomberg Technology. Google says it will do more to suppress terrorist propaganda. Alphabet Incorporated Google says it is creating new policies and practices to suppress terrorism-related videos, a response to UK lawmakers who have said the internet is a petri dish for radical ideology. So if you've spent any time online, which I think most everybody has, you know that there is lots of different sites out there with all kinds of different information and videos on YouTube and things like that that can be pretty outrageous in a lot of different ways and in some cases pushing what they call radical ideology. And so they're trying to get a hold on some of this. They say Google will increase its use of technology to identify extremist and terrorism-related videos across its sites, and those include YouTube, and will boost the number of people who screen for terrorism-related content, Google's general counsel, Kent Walker, wrote in an editorial in the Financial Times on Sunday. So they're getting some pressure because of these terror attacks. These governments are coming out and saying we need to stop the online terrorist ideas that are being put out there. And so these companies are feeling pressure to do something about it, including, as they say, increased technology to identify extremist and terrorism-related videos. They don't specify how they would do that exactly. Also, hire more people, I guess, to watch the videos and screen them for radical ideology, I suppose. They say the company will also be more aggressive in putting warnings on and limiting the reach of content that, while not officially forbidden, is still inflammatory. So what's interesting about that, I guess, is that who decides what's inflammatory or what isn't? Some things would be pretty clearly inappropriate, I suppose. But we live in such a strange society, in such a strange world, where what used to be inappropriate is not inappropriate. And some things that used to be fine are considered inappropriate. It's just a different way of looking at what's okay and what's not okay. So somebody's going to have to make those decisions and limit some videos or other content that's put out there. We'll see how that goes. They say, while we and others have worked for years to identify and remove content that violates our policies, the uncomfortable truth is that we, as an industry, must acknowledge that more needs to be done, Walker wrote. And so Google says it's going to do more to try to suppress terrorist propaganda. That'll be interesting to see how they try to do that. and to see who gets caught in that net. You know, if they cast a wide net there trying to limit what they feel is inappropriate, maybe they catch some people that are doing things that aren't inappropriate, but they might consider it to be that way. So that always gets into that argument of censorship. Can you censor what people say? How far does it go? Where's the you know, how far can you take a freedom of speech, that type of thing? So it will be interesting for these companies, especially because they don't just operate in the United States. Obviously, they're global companies. So different countries have different rules and different situations that they're dealing with. Here's another headline from over the weekend. This is kind of something a little bit new. This hasn't happened in a while. It's from The Independent. Russia to treat U.S. jets in Syria as targets after America guns down first regime warplane. And so, as you are well aware, I'm sure there's a lot of battles going on there in Syria. Lots of different countries involved, including the United States and Russia. And we're having these battles in that nation, that war-torn region. They say the country's defense ministry said the change in position would apply to all aircraft, including those operating as part of the U.S.-backed coalition. It will also suspend a hotline between Russia and the U.S. set up to prevent mid-air collisions. So with all these different nations flying aircraft above Syria, there has to be some sort of communication so they don't fly into each other or have problems. But apparently that's being suspended now, Russia says. The ministry said in a statement, all kinds of airborne vehicles, including aircraft and UAVs of the international coalition detected to the west of the Euphrates River, will be tracked by the Russian SAM systems as air targets. The warning followed after a U.S. F-18 Super Hornet shot down a Syrian Army Su-22 jet on Sunday in the countryside southwest of Raqqa, the first such downing of a Syrian jet by the U.S. since the start of the country's civil war in 2011. So this is 6 years on, and this is the first time the U.S. has downed a Syrian jet. And because of that, Russia is quite upset and now is threatening to, again, target planes or other flying vehicles from America or people that we would be working with. So that'll be interesting to see how that goes. It's all this talk of collusion between the U.S. and Russia, but apparently not when it comes to Syria. So anytime there's battles going on in a nation like that and there's other powers involved, there's always a threat of there being some difficulties. And here is a case of that over the weekend. So that's interesting to watch over there in Syria. And of course, I'm sure there'll be a lot more about that at thetrumpet.com. And the Trumpet Daily Radio Show often talks about that. And Watch Jerusalem, which was on earlier today. Those programs, a lot of times, deal with what's going on in the Middle East. And of course, thetrumpet.com does there as well. Well, one of the things going on in the United States, of course, is healthcare debate. That's something that's always on people's minds, especially since Obamacare came into place several years ago. And how is Obamacare doing? This is from CNN. Of course, the current administration has said they wanted to get rid of Obamacare and replace it with something else, but that still, I guess, is in the works. They say the list of insurers pulling out of Obamacare grows longer by the week. Humana, Aetna, Wellmark, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Anthem, Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Kansas City. Those have pulled out. And, of course, there have been, I think, others as well. Some are withdrawing from certain states while others are exiting completely, just getting out of the Obamacare entirely. Some are staying in some states but not others. These departures will leave tens of thousands of Americans in 47 counties around the nation without a choice of insurer on their exchange next year. That's not a good thing. It's always nice to have a choice. They say unless another carrier steps in. Why are they leaving? Well, the reasons behind the exits vary. Some insurers say they've lost millions of dollars on policies and don't want to lose any more. So they're not making money. And I don't think people are too concerned about whether the insurance company makes money or not. But at the end of the day, that's why they're in business, is to make some money. Some insurers say they'll offer Obamacare policies next year, but they have requested hefty rate hikes. So those that are staying in some cases, want to charge a lot more to the customer. And that's always the thing. If the rates go up or the costs go up for the insurance company, well, they pass it on to the people. CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield is looking for an average rate increase of 52% for its individual market plans in Maryland. And if you have Obamacare or some package in there, or you've had to work with that in some way, you know it's expensive. It's very expensive. And particularly, you know, if you are struggling to make the payment now and it goes up 52%, where's that money going to come from? I don't think, you know, if you look at people's, the economy, if you look at it on an individual basis, there's a lot of debt. People are struggling in a lot of cases. And so, you know, you can, as the old expression is, you can't get blood out of a turnip, right? I mean, it doesn't matter how much they raise it. If the money's not there, the money's not there. Cigna wants to raise premiums by 32% on average in North Carolina. So if you're listening there, you can expect that. And also Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is looking for an average 27% increase. So not every state, but a lot of states are having increases, some of them pretty significant. Again, they say insurers cite different reasons for the rate hikes. Some say they are still losing money because their policyholders are sicker than they expected, and premiums don't cover the cost of their care. Others blame skyrocketing prescription drug prices. So it doesn't seem like it's been a plan that has worked well from what I've seen of it and read of it and know of it. And I think the idea was supposedly that younger, healthier people would pay into the system, and that would fund people that had health issues and help them out. But, of course, what happens is the younger people or the healthier people, in a lot of cases, don't want to pay into the system. They'd rather just pay the penalty and move on because it's too expensive to pay for the insurance, and so there's not enough money in the system. And there's probably more to it than that, but that's some of what I have understood about it. So that's some of what's going on with Obamacare, you might be wondering, because there has been this idea that it would be replaced. It hasn't been totally replaced yet, but that's kind of where it sits for right now. But at the end of the day, the best thing, of course, is to be as healthy as you can be. Good little write-up here about habits I had to form to finally lose weight. This is something people a lot of times do struggle with, especially because the obesity rates are so high in the world today. And they have this write-up on it with a few points, but three of them that are pretty interesting and I think pretty common sense. Habits that had to be formed to lose weight, they say be active. Not a surprise there, I guess. They don't specify. I guess everybody would be a little bit different in what they would do. Be active. Limit sugar, and then cook mostly at home, but plan for meals out. So those are some tips that are pretty self-explanatory, I think, and good ones too. If you can have your weight at a good level, then you may not need the health care as much anyway. So those are some good tips that I think do tie into that those health issues. The airline industry has had some problems recently, as you know, a few high-profile cases and lawsuits back and forth, and sometimes it seems like that may open the door for more of that type of thing to happen with people losing or trying to have lawsuits and things like that. And this is a case here with American Airlines. This happened a few days ago. A loose beverage cart left American Airlines passenger with severe brain injury, lawsuit says. So if you've ever been on a plane, you know full well that there is a beverage cart that comes around. It's pretty heavy, and they always tell you to put your hands and your feet and your legs and arms inside the seat area, get them out of the aisle so they don't get hit by the cart. Well, somebody apparently had their head out there. A lawsuit filed Thursday in New York alleges that American Airlines failed to make an emergency stop after a beverage cart struck a passenger's head during takeoff, leaving the man with a severe brain injury. So trying to picture this, I'm guessing they did not secure the cart, which would be strange, but I suppose it could happen. And when they took off, it came down the aisle, and it hit this fellow whose head was apparently in the way. Charles and Helga Johnson from Stanfordville are seeking $10 million in damages from the airline stemming from the incident, according to Reuters. According to the complaint, a fully stocked beverage cart struck Charles Johnson in the head after it flew down the aisle during the plane's takeoff from Hartford, Connecticut to Charlotte in April 2016. So this happened a while ago, but the lawsuit's just coming up now. Johnson said the impact ripped off his hat, gave him a large forehead gash, severe bleeding, and a loss of consciousness. The complaint said the plane did not make an emergency landing and continued on its two-hour trek to Charlotte. That seems hard to believe. If you've ever been on a plane, I mean, anytime there's an incident, it seems like they're pretty quick to stop it. I do have a hard time envisioning this guy unconscious and bleeding out of his head, and they just moved on like it was no big deal. I really can't believe that, but that's what they claim anyway. They say the man says he now suffers from chronic traumatic brain injury and post-concussive syndrome, headaches, mood swings, and anxiety. He also has been unable to work because of the injuries, and so they want $10 million. The spokesman for American Airlines says the company is reviewing the complaint. So, could have happened. Hard to say. I mean, things can happen. There can be accidents. But it is just interesting now how it seems like different lawsuits are coming out of the woodwork. Maybe they're just being reported more now. But the airline industry certainly is having its fair share of problems. Somebody commented on it and said, how come nobody videotaped it? Because people are always taping everything with their phones, it seems like. And you'd think if this happened, somebody would have filmed it, but there's no film or no recording of it. So they'll have to go to court, determine what happened there. $10 million, that's the thought. This next one here is kind of interesting. If maybe you're familiar with these very popular toys. The most popular toy in the world right now, I think, at least in the West, is the fidget spinner, right? You probably have seen them. If you have a child, the child may have one. And I don't quite get the draw to them, but, you know, you hold it in your finger and you spin this contraption around, and people love them. They're selling out everywhere. But Germany's had enough. Germany is planning to destroy 35 tons of fidget spinners. The children are going to be in tears. Washington Post says that officials in Frankfurt, Germany, have decided to destroy thousands of seized fidget spinners deemed unsafe. These are being considered potential hazards as of now, and the country isn't going to stand for it anymore. They're going to destroy them. I'm not sure exactly why they're unsafe. I have seen some where pieces come out of them, and they have little circles, and those can come out, and a kid could choke on it, I'm sure, if they swallowed them. So, and I did see one story where somebody did swallow part of a fidget spinner. So I don't know that this is a big issue or a major hazard, but Germany thinks it is, and they're destroying 35 tons of fidget spinners. So that's going to be a sad day in Germany for the children. I don't know if they're all banned, but they're getting rid of certain types. They are very popular. They're so popular, in fact, that you may have heard of Kim Kardashian. She's famous for being famous. She released her own fidget spinner. She has her own. So if you're interested in the Kim Kardashian fidget spinner, you can get that one. And they say, although fidget spinners are everywhere this year, I mean, they're sold out, because if you go by certain stores, they'll have signs up in the windows saying that they have them. So you know that it's a hot item. The fidget spinner was actually invented back in the 1980s. So it's been around for a while. It's just caught on now. Catherine Hettinger created them as a toy to distract and soothe young children. Because her patent expired in 2005, though, she doesn't get any of the profits from the new popularity. But she said she's okay with that. So hopefully she's doing okay financially, because something that she came up with back in the 1980s now is the hottest toy there is. Except for in Germany, where they are destroying them and stealing the joy of the children, I guess. But they think they're dangerous over there. Today is the 19th of June. Here's a couple of things that have happened on this day in history, some important and some just interesting. 987 on this day, Louis IV was crowned King of France. 1846 on this day, the first officially recognized baseball game was played. The New York Nines defeated the Knickerbockers 23-1 at Hoboken, New Jersey. Not much of a contest. It was a blowout. The New York Nines and the Knickerbockers, teams that do not exist today. The Knicks are a basketball team, of course, but that's different. 1862 on this day, slavery outlawed in U.S. territory, so that was quite a change and a good one. 1941 on this day, Cheerios cereal invented an O-shaped cereal, so the one we're familiar with today, I guess. I don't know what it was like before then, but maybe they didn't have anything before that. In 1978 on this day, Garfield, the famous cartoon created by Jim Davis, first appears as a comic strip. And I don't know if it's as popular today, but I think the cat liked to eat lasagna, if I remember correctly. and had a dog and then the owner. So Garfield was created by Jim Davis and first appeared as a comic strip in 1978. Those are a couple of things, a few of the things that have happened on this day, June the 19th, in history. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm, and we have a live link at thetrumpet.com. You can also use the TuneIn app if you'd like to listen on your smart device. That's what they should do, is they should create a fidget spinner that's got a multimedia capability, so you could listen to us while you play with the fidget spinner. And also, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Email any comments you might have to comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those in. Key of David program is coming up today in just a little bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Robert Morley filling in today for your normal host, Stephen Fleury. I should say your usual host. They're all normal. Your usual host, Stephen Fleury, and a really good program today talking about some of the economic situations here in the United States and trust. The U.S. dollar, of course, and the economy is based on trust. And some things are changing within that, and that may undermine that trust. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio program. Also, Just the Best Literature today as well. Relating to the U.S. economy, some cities are doing well, while others are not doing as well. Here are the 15 fastest-growing U.S. cities. And if you live in these, or if you've been through them, you probably can relate to the growth with all the traffic and expansion that you see in some of these places. The 15th fastest growing U.S. city is San Antonio, New Braunfels, Texas. Number 14 is Austin, Round Rock, Texas. And I was just there recently, and I think it's growing. There's a lot of construction. There's a lot of road construction, and there are a lot of cars on the road as well. Number 13 fastest growing city in the U.S. is Tampa, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, Florida. Number 12 is Denver, Aurora, Lakewood, Colorado. Number 11, San Francisco, Oakland, Hayward, California. Number 10, Orlando, Kissimmee, Sanford, Florida. Number 9 is Seattle, Tacoma, Bellevue, Washington. That whole area is the 9th fastest growing area in the U.S. as far as cities. Number 8 is Washington, Arlington, Alexandria. That's there in the Virginia, Maryland area. Number 7, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, Florida. Number 6, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Anaheim. Number 5, where are they putting these people? Those are already full areas, but there are more people there now, I guess. Number 5, New York, Newark, New Jersey. Number 4, Phoenix, Mesa, Scottsdale, Arizona. These are the fastest growing U.S. cities. Number 3 is Atlanta, Sandy Springs, Roswell, Georgia. Number 2, Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And number 1, Houston, the Woodlands, Sugar Land, Texas. Those are the fastest growing U.S. cities. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 of them are in Texas. So Texas is booming for whatever reason. The economy is good, I guess. A lot of people going to Texas and the coasts. You don't see a lot of growth there in those cities inland as much, but we've got a story about that here in just a minute, about some of the division between the smaller areas of the country and those big cities. Also, make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. This relates to economy as well. The top story, Illinois on the Verge of Bankruptcy, by Tyrell Shalhoti. We're like a banana republic. We can't manage our money. And they don't mean the store, by the way. They're talking about a banana republic that is, as you would see in this world. Also, Puerto Rico's $123 billion bankruptcy will impact more than your wallet. That's by Robert Morley. And the economy is booming again, right? Question. Those are the top stories today on thetrumpet.com. A lot about economy. And unfortunately, fairly often, the news about the economy is not all that good. And so those are some of those top stories to check out there at thetrumpet.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, take a look at this really interesting piece from The Guardian, The Great American Fallout, How Small Towns Came to Resent the Bigger Cities. We'll talk about that next right here on Trumpet Radio Live.
Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG is made possible by the Philadelphia Church of God. The Philadelphia Church of God produces the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and Royal Vision Christian Living Magazine. The church publishes a range of free educational books and booklets about the Bible, history, and current events. The church also produces a weekly television program, The Key of David with Gerald Fleury.
The PCG supports Herbert W. Armstrong College with campuses in Edmond, Oklahoma and Edstone, England. It also sponsors the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation with musical activities in Edmond and biblical archaeology in Jerusalem, Israel. The PCG produces KPCG, broadcasting online and at 101.3 FM from the church's home campus in North Edmond. Information about the Philadelphia Church of God is available on its website, pcog.org.
Thanks for joining us here today on Trumpet Radio. This is Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, too. Thanks for joining us there around the world, a lot of places, locally here in Edmond, Oklahoma City, and also around the world there at kpcg.fm. Thanks for tuning in, spending some of your Monday with us. Over the weekend, the movies that came out that were very popular, the number one movie was Cars 3. If you've seen any of those, if you have kids, you probably have one of those Cars movies. They're animated. That was a popular movie, finally beat out Wonder Woman, which was has been extremely popular movie over the summer. They say, despite signs of franchise fatigue, Pixar and Disney's Cars 3 dominated the road at the North American box office. The threequel opened to an estimated $53.5 million, and that was enough to beat out the ruling champion of the movies, Wonder Woman. Overseas, Cars debuted at $21.3 million, and so it's doing well. And I guess it's smart to release a movie like that on Father's Day because the kids probably want to take Dad to see the movie that they want to see, which is the way it usually goes on some of those Father's Day activities. But so that was a popular movie over the weekend, and $53.5 million. We were talking before the break about some of the cities in the U.S. that are growing. And interesting note before we get to one of our main stories here. And this is from over in Seoul, South Korea. They have done something kind of neat within the city. South Korea's, I think it's called Sulo, 7017 Sky Garden, which opened in late May, is exactly that, a garden in the sky. The over 3,000-foot-long plant village is built on a former highway overpass that runs through the center of the capital, not unlike New York City's High Line. Dutch studio MVRDV won a government commission to build the park 2 years ago and designed its thoroughfare to hold 24,000 plants. The park is likely to eventually expand and may become an urban nursery that grows trees or shrubs that can be transplanted elsewhere in the city. So it's pretty neat. I mean, they're in the middle of this sprawling city. It's this old overpass that they're not using anymore, so they decided to put a lot of plants up there and make it into a garden. People can walk, and they put up plexiglass, it looks like, sides, so people don't fall, of course, and have these nice plants right there in the downtown area. So that's kind of a neat idea, a good use of an old overpass, and something they're doing kind of nice there inside of, a sprawling city, but they're making it a little nicer for people. So that's kind of nice to see. This story here is really interesting. This is from The Guardian. And it's written by the author, is Catherine J. Kramer. And the title is The Great American Fallout, How Small Towns Came to Resent Cities. So we've talked a fair bit recently here on KPCG, and it's been written about in The Trumpet, of course, and a lot of good write-ups there about the division in the United States. There has been quite a bit of division over a variety of topics, social issues, and other things like that. And so this piece here from The Guardian talks about this division in terms of where people are living and some of the issues that they are having with, I guess, this idea of the small communities versus these big urban areas. And so Catherine J. Kramer in The Guardian writes this: Joe gathers with his friends every morning over coffee to solve the problems of the world. With a wink, they call themselves the Downtown Athletic Club. The closest downtown is 30 miles away. So I guess it's an ironic name. They are a mix of independent contractors in construction trades, an independently employed auto mechanic, and several retired public school teachers. They have a mix of political leanings among them, but most of them openly support Donald Trump. She says, you might not always guess it, but after the cost of health care and gas, the most frequent topic of conversation is economic inequality. which many of the group blame on corporate CEOs. They say the other big issue, I think, for our whole nation is the discrepancy between workers and bosses. That's what Gary says. He's one of the retired teachers that is part of this coffee clatch. He says the top of the corporations are taking off profits greater than ever before in history, and that's really driving a bigger separation between the richest in America, and the common belief is that we're losing the middle class. So they're upset about money, finances. The author says, does he share this belief? Well, the business element is the town is dying, he says, as if it were both so obvious and so familiar to him that it was barely worth comment. He says all the small towns in the area are having a hard time keeping grocery stores and gas stations and everything. So, of course, if you've been through a small town, you've seen this, or if you live in a small town, you've seen this. There's not a lot of local businesses anymore. They're harder to find. And this author says, I have been visiting coffee clatches and residence groups throughout the state of Wisconsin since 2007. I seek them out in various types of places to understand how they are making sense of politics. From the very beginning, the conversations in small communities like this one surprised me, she says. I have heard time and time again about the struggle to make ends meet and the lack of response from anyone with the power to make life better. I have heard men like Joe say, those quote-unquote idiots, who tell us to drive less have no clue what our lives are like. And so she's referencing some people in this group that just talk about the politics of the day, their frustration with, say, people coming out and being concerned about climate change and you shouldn't drive as much and all of these sort of high-minded ideals, when their reality is that they can't make ends meet and they're just trying to survive and survive financially and provide for their families. And so the idea of saving the planet or things like that don't appeal to them quite as much when they're just trying to get by day to day. She says these groups have a class analysis of what is going on in their country. And what's going on is essentially about where things are going to the cities. So the thought here is that, of course, business, money, it's all leaving the rural communities and going to the bigger cities. In a lot of cases, coastal cities, but not always, but just the bigger cities. And so there's a divide there between the people, those in those smaller communities and those in the bigger ones. She writes, the members of the Downtown Athletic Club don't want to live in a downtown, but they do know that society as a whole confers respect to such places. There is a sense in conversations that people in rural America are not getting their fair share of attention, resources, and respect. They think they deserve more and that cities and the people within them are getting more than they deserve. They mainly blame racial and ethnic minorities, but also white urban elites. So they don't like the way the money is going into the bigger cities. They don't like the way the money is being spent, they think, on social programs when they're struggling in the rural communities. So I guess in this last election, there was a pretty big divide between the local rural communities and the bigger city areas. If you look at the electoral map, it was, in a lot of cases, split that way. And so this is an interesting look at what some of the people in those rural communities are concerned about. She says, people living in rural communities across the U.S. face difficult odds. American economic growth and recovery is concentrated in a small number of highly populated urban counties, such as L.A. County in California and Miami-Dade in Florida. And that list we looked at earlier, if you remember, of the 15 fastest-growing cities in the U.S., one of them was Los Angeles, that area, and other ones were down there in Florida. So that's where a lot of the recovery is. I guess if you want to call it that, there could be plenty of debate there. But maybe that's where some of the growth is at this time in those cities. But it's not affecting the nation across the board. The rural population is declining from more than half of the U.S. population in 1910 to just 20% in 2010. You believe that? Only 20% of the U.S. population is in those more rural communities in 2010. The abandoned main streets show the wear and tear of an economy that has shifted away from rural people and of public policy that has forgotten to pay attention to them. So the politicians, you know, in a lot of cases, are going to look at where the people are because that's who's going to give them their power. And they're looking at these bigger community or these bigger population centers, which are not rural areas. So the rural people feel like they are being forgotten. The article continues, the perspective that people in rural communities don't get their fair share of attention from decision makers in cities, public dollars, or respect set the stage for Donald Trump. These people were saying that government is basically an urban entity driven by decisions made in cities. Their dying towns were evidence that whatever government was doing, it was not working for people like them. And so they think that's why a lot of the vote went to President Trump, is because even though there's not a lot of population in these areas, still those areas mostly went towards President Trump because of the economic conditions that they're in and the concerns that they have personally in their lives. These people in the rural communities, they say they work hard, they said, often in multiple jobs, and still couldn't afford health care. So here comes Obamacare again. They're working hard. They're being told they need to pay their fair share. They can't afford it. They just can't afford it, and these bills and these taxes are coming their way. The article says, so how could it be right that they were paying for the health care and pensions for public workers? When Obamacare came around, how could it be possible that a program designed by people who paid no attention to them was making their lives better? And so those are interesting points. And the personal finance is a major concern, obviously, for people. They told me, the author writes, and again, these are people from rural communities in Wisconsin, this particular article is about. They told me they weren't opposed to government spending outright, but in their mind, if they paid higher taxes for things like public education, the chances were slim that their money would come back to their community. And that's what people want to see, is the tax dollars they spend come back to help their community, obviously. I think that's pretty logical. The Monday morning after the 2016 election, in a gas station in a logging town in northwest Wisconsin, the author says, I asked a group of retired and working men what they thought Trump would do to help them. Ron, a logger, replied, nothing. Nothing. We're used to living in poverty. We're used to it. It's not ever going to change. How many times do we have to tell you that? But you don't listen. But then he told the author that the country had to try something different, even if it wasn't going to help his town. So they didn't think that necessarily President Trump would come in and make anything different, but they just said we need some sort of a change because they did not like the direction things were going. And they were asked, well, why exactly did you vote for President Trump if you don't think he's going to help anything? And they said, because this country has got to change. It's wrong. And when you have guys that are on these programs driving around $60,000 pickups, it's not fair to the people who have been going to work all their life. And then another guy spoke up, and he was more left-leaning. His name was Mitch, and he was, again, at this place there in Wisconsin where she was talking to some people after the election. And he said, I agree with that now, and I'm on the other side of the fence. I vote mostly Democratic, but I hate the giveaways. I can't stand it. It's wrong. It's real wrong. So there are people on both sides of the aisle, but one thing that they do agree on is they hate the money being given away to basically social programs where they see their own communities struggling, and they feel like their money, their tax dollars, aren't coming back to help them. So they're upset about that, and that shows some of the divide between the rural communities and the bigger cities, and highlights some of the division within the United States. It's an interesting write-up. It's from The Guardian. You can read the rest of that if you'd like to. The Great American Fallout, How Small Towns Came to Resent Cities. There is a real divide there. Even when you read the comments on that article, there's a division in the comments. The people from the cities, they have one perspective, and then the people from the rural communities have a different perspective, and it doesn't seem like they're meeting in the middle at this time. But it is interesting. President Eisenhower was faced with social and racial issues when he was president. And his right after World War II, and his response to it was sort of interesting. Basically, he said if the economy was good and people were making money and prospering, a lot of the divisions that were in the country would somewhat subside. Not that they would be solved necessarily, but they would be soothed. And I don't know if he was right or wrong on that, but it seems like it did help anyway. If people feel like they're doing well economically, I think they're willing to let a lot slide. And so when you end up having these financial problems and this division between the financial situations in these rural communities versus the big cities, I think it's hard to bridge that gap. And that's one of the reasons that there is a lot of division here in the United States. And you might be wondering, where is it going as far as the finances? There's a lot you can see at thetrumpet.com that talks about that and what you can expect to see happening in the near future here in the United States when it comes to economy. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. One other story today for you that's pretty interesting. Before we jump into that, though, here's a quick note on something that might be of interest to some people. There are people that really do enjoy playing different types of games, strategy games, board games, and such. There's a new book out called It's All a Game. What's in a Board Game? Board games tend to feel timeless, but as author Tristan Donovan argues in his new book, It's All a Game, the ways board games evolve reflect the values of the time. They say consider the game of life, which began in 1860 as a thinly disguised Sunday school sermon, according to the author, because it promoted virtues and it punished vices. A century later, as American industry boomed, it was remarked with a capitalistic message, with a capitalistic message. And by the 1990s, the financial side still mattered, but the introduction of life tiles rewarded more intangible accomplishments. Games of the 1960s showed certain attitudes that were changing, and you can look down through history, I guess, of the United States and see different games reflecting the attitudes of the times. And so that's kind of an interesting book if people are interested in that. It's all a game. It's about the board games. I guess now you could talk about online games too. But board games are still popular, and it does reflect the society that is around us. This is a very interesting write-up here from The Telegraph. I think people have always, known that if you are depressed or you're feeling sad, it's not good for your health. The Bible talks about that in a lot of cases. About having a merry heart, and it helps you feel better in general. But this is from The Telegraph. It says, time does not mend a broken heart as scientists find condition causes long-term damage. Of course, it would depend on your attitude, I guess. They say a new study has concluded that not even the clock can always mend a broken heart, particularly, I guess, if a person stays in a depressed state. A team of medical researchers from the University of Aberdeen have said that so-called broken heart syndrome, which I didn't know was a thing but apparently is, can leave physical scars that never recover. British Heart Foundation-funded study followed 52 patients over 4 months, aged between 28 and 87, so a pretty good range there, who suffered with what is officially known as Takotsubo syndrome. I wish they would make their syndromes easier to pronounce, but that's close. The little-known condition was first coined in Japan in 1990 and named after the native word for an octopus pot, of course, which has a unique shape that resembles a broken left ventricle. So the interesting way of naming this syndrome. It is provoked when the heart muscle is suddenly stunned, causing the left ventricle to change shape, and is typically prompted by intense emotional or physical stress. So a lot of times this happens where, and I don't know if it's because of this syndrome, but you'll see, you know, particularly when people are older, you'll see people that have been married for a long time, maybe one will die and then the remaining spouse dies shortly thereafter. This does happen from time to time. Don't know if it's related to this, but there is something here as far as the being suddenly stunned or having intense emotional or physical stress. It does change what happens with the actual heart muscle. They say it affects the heart's ability to pump blood, and according to the study, there remains no known medical cure. It would just be, I guess, getting over the sadness of something, but they don't know what else to do. Around 3,000 people per year in the UK suffer from the rare syndrome, which mostly affects women, they say. This study has shown that in some patients who develop this syndrome, various aspects of heart function remain abnormal for up to 4 months afterwards, so it can last for quite some time. Worryingly, these patients' hearts appear to show a form of scarring, indicating that full recovery may take much longer or indeed may not occur with current care, so it can have long-term damage. They say this highlights the need to urgently find new and more effective treatments for this devastating condition. The team in Aberdeen used ultrasound and cardiac MRI scans to look at how their patients' hearts were functioning. The results showed that the syndrome permanently affected the heart's pumping motion and delayed the ringing motion made by the beating heart. So when these people have a very traumatic event occur, could be loss of a loved one or something like that, they actually, the heart does actually change shape, not in every case, but in some of these cases, and to the point where the pumping motion and the delayed ringing motion made by the heart, you know, it was changed. So really interesting. I mean, you know, everybody knows that sadness would cause a person to feel not great, but there are actually, now they can see scientifically that, okay, well, it actually does change the physical way that your heart would work in this case. So it is very interesting when we see things come out and proved in science that, I mean, the Bible's talked about for, you know, as long as it's been there, for a long, long time. And so, but this gives some scientific backing to that. The heart, this article continues and says, the heart's squeezing motion was also affected, and parts of the heart muscle suffered scarring, which affected its elasticity and prevented it from contracting properly. So, you know, real issues there that will affect overall health and potentially cause some severe issues. Dr. Dana Dawson, reader in cardiovascular medicine at the University of Aberdeen, who led the research, said, we used to think that people who suffered from Takotsubo cardiomyopathy would fully recover without medical intervention. So they knew this occurred, but they figured, give them time and it'll get better. But she says, here we've shown that this disease has much longer-lasting damaging effects on the hearts of those who suffer from it. Figures show that between 3% and 17% of sufferers die within 5 years of diagnosis. So, again, I think we probably all can think of certain situations where that's happened, whether we knew about it personally or we just read about it, where somebody dies and then a close, you know, spouse or somebody dies not too long after that. I don't know if it's related to this, but it certainly could be. Around 90% of females, female and stressful and the stressful trigger often associated the sudden death of a loved one, that's identified in around 70% of cases. Sometimes it could be something else, but most cases, 70% of the cases, it's because of the loss of a loved one. In the majority of cases, however, the left ventricle returns to normal over a few days, weeks, or months. So again, it's not that this happens to everybody to this extreme you know, case to where there would be long-term damage and so forth, but it does happen to some. So it does show the importance of attitude, mentality, that type of thing in going through a time of grief. And in related to this, journalists speculated whether actress Debbie Reynolds' death in September, one day after her daughter Carrie Fisher of Star Wars fame, was caused by a broken heart. And so when you hear, you know, died of a broken heart, that's kind of, it seems a little bit nebulous, but it can happen to people where they have problems with it. They don't know that for sure, of course, but of course, I think everyone remembers Carrie Fisher. She was Princess Leia there in Star Wars. She died recently, and then her mother, who is famous, died just shortly thereafter. And so people kind of wonder, the doctors wonder, journalists wonder, I guess, whether or not this sort of grief played into that. The study is published today in the Journal of American Society of Echocardiography. So if you can pronounce it, then you should probably have a subscription. If you can't, like me, then I probably shouldn't have a subscription to that. But it's from the Telegraph, the write-up about it. Time does not mend a broken heart as scientists find condition causes long-term damage. Just really interesting. And it does show, I think, how just attitude is really important, even on physical health. Very, very important. And how people deal with stress or grief or those types of things. So that's an interesting write-up. Make sure you listen for the Kia David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Robert Morley, filling in today. Really interesting program about some of the aspects of the U.S. economy that you need to pay attention to, especially as the stock market continues to rise and rise and rise. But where is it all heading? Is it good or bad? There's some growth in some sectors, I suppose, but there's problems in other areas as well. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming your way today. Also, Just the Best Literature and watch Jerusalem. If you can't catch these shows live, it's not a problem. You can get the archives online at kpcg.fm, and you can find them at thetrumpet.com as well. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. A lot of economy news there as well. Top story, Illinois on the verge of bankruptcy. We're like a banana republic. We can't manage our money. That's by Tyrell Schlody. And I think actually Chicago is one of the cities that people are trying to get out of, if they can. Also related to that, Puerto Rico's $123 billion bankruptcy will impact more than your wallet. And the economy is booming again, right? Those are some of the write-ups today at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and check those out. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining me. And again, make sure you listen for the programming coming up here on KPCG, and also check out thetrumpet.com. For myself, Dwight Falk, have a great rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.